Welcome to the Employee Benefits Show. This is George Grumbacher. Joining me today is Stephanie Fierro, an attorney with Jaberg Wilk here in Phoenix, Arizona. And we're going to be talking about estate planning and providing you with practical, actionable, and understandable information. Let's get right into it. Stephanie, what do people need to know about estate planning?
I think the most important thing that people need to know is that, yes, it's a morbid topic, but going through the process doesn't have to be a morbid exercise. This is really about making sure that your family and friends and whatever else interests you are taken care of when you're not here to take care of them yourself.
Okay.
So it's a very cathartic process if it's done properly.
Yeah, I bet.
So one of the things that we want people to keep in mind are all of the benefits of having an estate plan in place. It's really something that people need to make sure that they do, because if they don't, the state imposes certain kind of,
they make it harder.
They make it harder. They impose their own estate plan for you. They have statutory defaults that would go into effect and would essentially make all of those decisions for you. So we tend, as a general rule, society tends to be a little bit of a control freak about what we do in our daily lives.
Right.
But it's so interesting to me that all of these last decisions that need to be made are left to statutory default because so many people don't do them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that I think people really need to take advantage of the fact that they can make these decisions and should make these decisions so somebody else isn't making them for them.
Got it. Being a little bit proactive.
Yes.
So when I think about estate planning, some of the things I think about are wills, trusts, powers of attorney, and guardianship.
Okay.
Are those some of the more common?
That is true. That is what I lovingly refer to as the starter package.
Okay.
So like a starter home, these are the basic documents that I believe everyone should have in place. If you've got stuff or people that you care about, these are the documents that are going to make sure that whatever you want to have happen gets actually put into place. So yes, what we're talking about are powers of attorney. You've got a financial power of attorney and a healthcare power of attorney.
Okay.
They serve different functions, obviously, as they're named. The financial power of attorney steps in when you're not able to make or communicate decisions for yourself and make sure that the person that you've nominated can go in, make sure your bills are paid, make sure that if you were in the middle of a transaction that they can complete that transaction for you and do everything that you would do with the caveat that they're acting on your behalf.
Okay.
The healthcare power of attorney is probably the least altruistic of all of the documents because that's the one that says what happens to you as an actual physical person if you're not able to make or communicate healthcare decisions. So you essentially designate an agent to make all of the gruesome decisions for you. Now, by and large, the healthcare power of attorney is the most gruesome of the documents. That's where we're talking about if I am in a persistent vegetative state, an irreversible coma or terminal condition. What's the care that I would ask for if I could actually communicate what I wanted? And by that I mean, do I want heroic measures, CPR, food and fluids by intravenous administration and those sorts of things? So that's one that's really important to get in place because that's one you don't want to put somebody in the position of having to think about, oh, do they want to be kept alive
right.
under these circumstances? Do they not? But it's important to keep in mind, with the exception of a very, very limited number of powers, primarily whether you want to donate your body, your organs, and what you want to have happen to your body, whether it's cremation or burial, powers of attorney die with you. So as soon as you die, those powers are not effective. I can't tell you how many times people say, so-and-so died, I'm their power of attorney. It doesn't matter at that point. Then what we need is the will. We need at least a will and or a trust.
Okay. Before we jump into that, what are some examples when, if I got in an accident or if I get sick, that's when those powers of attorney would be used?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most common scenario that people can wrap their mind around is you're in an accident and you're unconscious and you're not able to make or communicate decisions. And let's say that accident was very, very traumatic and the doctors have decided that there's nothing else that they can do for you. Do you want to be kept in a persistent vegetative state for a prolonged period of time, which will presumably be very expensive and not give you any meaningful recovery? So that's one of the things that people need to be aware of. And that's what that document does, is it says, no, enough, or it says, yes, keep trying.
Got it. Okay, nice. And so you were about to roll into a conversation about potentially wills and trusts?
Yeah, so wills and trusts. If you have a trust, you should still have a will, okay? Okay. So because what happens is the will becomes what's known as a pour-over. It acts as a safety net just to make sure that everything gets over to the trust. But for people that perhaps don't necessarily have the need for a trust, because that comes up under certain circumstances. For example, if someone has a minor child, meaning a child under the age of 18, that they would presumably not want them to get their entire estate if something happened to them where they can't control it and they get it at the age of 18.
Okay, so if I was worth $1 million and I passed away when my kid was 16, and when he turns 18, he would theoretically get all that money.
Right, he's
and
potentially
then make
got
great financial decisions.
Right. I don't care how mature you are at 18. If somebody hands you $1 million, you're not going to make the best decisions.
Probably not.
So what happens then is a will allows you to potentially control that property, though your ability to control it for a prolonged period of time is limited. But it also, more importantly, allows you to designate a guardian. You mentioned guardianship earlier. Mm. This is the place where you would make that decision. Arizona, which is one of many states that allow you to do it, but not all states allow you to do it, but Arizona does, allows a parent to designate the person that they would want to take care of their children if something were to happen to them. That is where a lot of people, especially with minor children, kind of get a little bit choked up, because you don't like the idea of planning for that. Our goal is to plan for the worst and hope for the best.
Sure.
Statistically, very likely to not be an issue, but in the event that it is, it's the grown-up decision that needs to be made. And so you can designate who you want to be in charge of raising the kids if something happens to you.
Got it. Now, if I don't do that, if I don't have a guardian named, what will happen?
Then essentially what happens is people will come and petition the court, and the court has to decide among those people who's going to be best suited to take care of the child.
Okay. So the court gets to decide that.
Yeah. And now parental nomination is given a great deal of deference, and that's why we want to make sure that that gets taken care of.
Makes sense to me. Okay.
Now, the other purpose of a will is to make sure that if you do not have a trust, it's going to dispose of your property. So it's going to say where your property goes and what amounts and under what circumstances. If you have a more sizable estate, or you have minor children where you don't want them to necessarily get full access to the money right away, then a trust can be a very useful vehicle. Most commonly, what we're talking about is a revocable trust. What that means is the person has the right to change their mind about it at any time during their lifetime while they have capacity.
Okay.
So
capacity means?
Means the mental ability to change the document.
I see.
So if they were in one of those accidents, for example, and let's say they regained some capacity but did not have technical legal capacity, the document would then become irrevocable. They wouldn't have the ability to change it.
I see.
So what happens under the trust is you transfer property to it during your lifetime. What that does is it allows you to potentially bypass the probate process. Now, not very many people are confident about understanding what the probate process is. So probate is simply the process by which the court analyzes all of the information presented to it and decides who now has legal title to the property because the property owner died.
Okay.
When you have a trust, you transfer title during your lifetime to this trust instrument. So essentially what happens is we don't need the probate court to determine who has power to transfer the property, because as long as there's a trustee who can serve under the document, we know that the trustee has the power to dispose of the property, and you can bypass that process. So it's very helpful for that. It's also helpful for what's known as dead hand control.
Ooh.
Okay, let's just cut to the chase, right? I mean, that's really at the end of the day what we're talking about here. But it allows you to continue to control how and when property is accessed by the beneficiaries of your estate. So for example, if someone has a child who has not historically made the best decisions, whether that's drugs, alcohol, or something more benign, then the person making the trust can say, okay, trustee, if you have reason to believe that my child is addicted to drugs or alcohol at the time, then you don't have to make distributions to them. Or you can make distributions to pay rent or other things, but not necessarily give them unfettered access to the property.
Got it.
So it's really useful.
Excellent. When should somebody think about getting started with this?
In my opinion, once somebody turns the age of 18, they should really look at having at least powers of attorney put in place. But when we get stuff, when we accumulate things, whether that's real property, meaning homes and land and those sorts of things, or any tangible personal property of any value, or you have people in your life that you care about, now's as good a time as any to start looking at the process.
Got it. I would think that a common time that people actually do it is when they have kids, or perhaps they experience a death in the family, and that sort of motivates them to actually take action.
Yeah. Big life events are usually when people start really considering doing this or amending the plan that they may have in place. And so we're talking birth, death, marriage, divorce. Those are all very common times to reevaluate or visit this for the first time.
Got it. Okay. Some good motivators. And if my wife and I are considering going through this process, who else should we be talking to about it? Aside from an attorney, should I be talking to potential guardians that would watch my kids? Or?
So it's funny. It's about a 50-50 in terms of who people really want to talk to about the decisions that they're going to make. Some people feel that this is something that they want to keep very close to the vest. They don't want anybody to know that they designated one sister as the guardian instead of the other. But in my opinion, if you're going to ask somebody to potentially raise your children, you might want to make sure that they're on board for that, because these are nominations, okay?
Right.
That's what I try and remind people. You can nominate anybody. You could nominate your neighbor just to tick them off if you wanted to. I would advise against that. But they have to accept the nomination. So when the time comes, they have to be willing to serve in that position. So it's usually a good idea to give people a heads up. Understanding, of course, that you may not want to disclose all of the details, but just see, hey, if I were to name you in this document, would that be something that you'd be willing to do? And it's okay for you to say no. And that's something that can be very helpful. But what I would like people to keep in mind is that estate plans are very personal. They are very subject to change based on your own unique set of circumstances, whether that's your family situation, your money situation, whatever that is. So in speaking with friends and family, keep in mind, estate planning is not one size fits all. So take any unsolicited advice that you may get from friends or family members with a grain of salt. It doesn't mean it's going to work for you. So advisors are really going to be in the key position to help with that. Other people that can be helpful, if you've amassed a little bit of wealth or anything that may be under the control of a financial planner, they're usually very helpful in making sure beneficiary designations are kept up to date. And a CPA, if you're working with an accountant, they have a better idea of what's been going on with your taxes historically, whether you may have made any gifts historically that would be required to be reported to the IRS and those sorts of things. So any sort of professional advisor are the best place to start. And obviously, you're going to talk to your friends and family, and we get that.
Got it. Okay, excellent. So how do people get started with this?
So there are a couple of different things that people should keep in mind. There are plenty of employers that offer legal plans under their employee benefits. If they have that type of a plan, looking there is a good place to start, because sometimes they do actually have will, trust, and estate planning options under those plans. In the absence of that, then get a referral or do a little bit of online research to find a qualified estate planning attorney who you can meet with. Generally, what I like to do is I sit down with people for about an hour. We set up a consultation where we go over what you've got, who you care about, and what you want the plan to do for you. And then we will figure out an estimate of what the overall cost will be for your unique set of facts and circumstances. And then we would go through an engagement process and get started on drafting everything.
Okay, excellent. And how much does that initial conversation cost?
It depends. Most estate planning attorneys will charge their normal hourly rate, but you should also ask whether they're willing to credit that if they do retain you for services against the overall cost, most will do.
So always best just to ask the questions.
Yeah. And we understand that you need to have an understanding of what the overall cost is going to be. Mm-hmm. And we do the best that we can to estimate that on the front end so that you're not surprised.
Excellent. Stephanie, where can people learn more about you?
You can go to jbergwilk.com and look for the attorneys. And you'll find a link to all of my contact information there.
Excellent. We will have that listed in the show notes. As always, you can click Contact Us in the notes of the show, and we'll get you any applicable information or answer any questions. And as always, make it a great day.